saying up here that the tape recorder is kind of terrifying to people. You know, you get all ready to say something and somebody turns it on and then you freeze like that. Now, that doesn't always work that way. We tried an experiment at home two summers ago when we were doing a number of panels on people who work with corrections. And we had five groups. We planned to have four groups for discussion. It turned out that we had enough people, so we had to have five groups. But we had intended to have a tape recorder for each group so that we could see what they talked about without being there. Now, one group didn't have a tape recorder. We had more difficulty about that because they had the feeling that we didn't care about them. And we didn't care what they said. It wasn't going to be important. Didn't want to preserve it for posterity or anything of that sort. So sometimes you get turned on along with the machine. Well, it's turned off. As you can imagine what Paul has just been talking about in the idea of being out of the context of the nation. You can't use law internationally because there isn't a body there and you ought to do it in terms of self-interest rather than trying to use law. This would be sort of like the caveman who managed to put together his family. And he said to his family, now everybody knows that a family is ordained. It has an internal integrity all of its own. And one day somebody in his family would come along and say that other family over there has been trampling on our domain here. Shouldn't we do something about this? Shouldn't we sit down and make a treaty with them? Shouldn't we have a little inter-family law here? At which part the father of the household would say, well, obviously they aren't a part of this family. And we're just talking here law in terms of interpersonal relationships. And don't go messing around trying to organize a geographical area or you put together a bigger block, because law won't work where there isn't already an incorporated into one subsystem all of the people that you're trying to work with. Don't do silly things like trying to form a state government or a national government. Just pick up your axe and bash their heads in and have it over with. Well, that's the unkindest interpretation I can give of what Paul is saying today. It is, don't mess around outside of the area that's already organized. But I think that one could at least make an argument that runs the other way, and that is that you gradually move and broaden the area or the arena within which law can be effective. Now, in order to do this, you have to mess around in areas that aren't already incorporated into your legal system. And perhaps I can talk a little bit about that today. Before doing that, I want to say that how delighted I was last night to find out that in aiming at Paul Hayne, I also got Paul Bowman. I don't remember exactly what I said last night, but I'm sure that it came out fairly close to this, Paul, that the less we know about a subject, the more dogmatic we get. And I found out that the guy teaches dogmatics. Well, this happens to me in my business, too. Every time somebody wants to say that something isn't important, they say, well, that's just an academic question. It happens that academics is what I value rather highly. Paul suggested for us this morning some very interesting ideas, and I'd like to try and get back into them in a different setting. I had thought originally that I'd talk about some criminal law problems this morning. I'd like to postpone that until Thursday now, and instead talk about some problems of poverty, because if I understood Paul correctly, he's going to go there Thursday morning, and it's only fair that you get straightened out so that you won't be misled too much when he starts. I will, however, take it on a domestic level, and Paul will be addressing himself, as I understood, to the international problems, which are, of course, on a different scale. Guilt and innocence, as he has said this morning, are not very good bases to start with when you're working with law. When one confuses the idea of punishment, that is retribution, with the notion of utility, you're on fairly shaky ground, I think. It's better to look at the question of what works, what has utility, when you're talking about doing something by rules. And the rest of that thought I would like to save for Thursday morning, because it obviously hits a lot more in the criminal law area than it does here. Nonetheless, it is an important place to start. A law ought to, as a tool, service. It ought to accomplish a job that we want done. It isn't very difficult to design rules. You might have called them laws. I would prefer to think of them as rules. For some things that are fairly mechanical and that are fairly testable, where you can see whether or not it's working. One can, for example, think of electrical codes, wiring codes, or plumbing codes, or a million other things where you know what it is that you want to do, and you can write the rule book, and then if you do it that way, you know, not over so many elbows to so many feet of pipe if you want to have an efficient water system, this kind of thing, you can test it out. Now, in that, you don't really ask the question of goodness or badness or rightness or wrongness in the sense of what sometimes is called morality or innocence and guilt. You ask the questions of utility. Does it work? Does it get the job done? Now, it seems to me that's important. It's also important to think that there may be an overtone of getting a person to do what you want him to do by operating the conditions around him, by changing conditions that come to bear upon him. I suppose that our leading exponent of this kind of thinking in the United States today is a professor by the name of Skinner that I'm sure that many of you know about, probably read, the theory of operant conditioning, that if you reward what you want and punish what you don't want, that gradually a person learns to anticipate the rewards and the punishments. It's the old Pavlov's dogs all over again, this kind of thing. Professor Skinner teaches this for training conduct and changing conduct a lot. There is an event that demonstrates that Skinner has some validity to what he's talking about. He's teaching his students a few years ago got together with a little conspiracy of their own, and they agreed that when Professor Skinner would come into the room, that when he would stand over here near this corner of the room, that they would sit up and they would look interested. They'd laugh at his jokes and they'd take notes and everything would go fine like this. And as he would begin to walk away from that corner, their interest would abate and they would become more and more drowsy. And when he'd get over the other side, they would sit there and yawn and look out the windows. The interesting thing was that here was operant conditioning, full tilt, you see, going, and Skinner didn't recognize it. All that he knew was that within 3 or 4 days, he was plastered in that corner. Now, this happens. There's no question but what you can by changing the environment around one or around a nation or around a group. You can, by operating on the conditions surrounding them, lead them to do certain things. It's also true, though, I think, that there is such a thing as free will. That even though it's hard to kick against the pricks, that sometimes people do kick against the pricks. That you do irrational things. And you notice that Paul wound up this morning with the observation that if we were rational, that if we were had full knowledge about our own interests and we were going to act reasonably, that we wouldn't fight. That is, there wouldn't be such a thing as war, because war is essentially an irrational act. So is all crime. So is poverty. These are irrational things because we are not making the best deployment of our own resources and what we have to take care of ourselves. Why do we behave irrationally? Here is a theological point, I think, that one must observe, and that is that man does not have full knowledge. He is not full-spirited in terms of wanting to do for others the best that he can do for them. Rather, it is a matter of seeing selfishly what I think is best for my own welfare and with a clouded vision of that. There's a real tendency for me as a lawyer to get over and talk about theology, for exactly the same reason that Hayne, as a theologian, likes to talk about law. It's not his discipline, so he chooses to talk about law. Theology is not my discipline, so I choose to talk about theology. That's because it's so comfortably to be ignorant in the area in which you're working. When you get into the area in which you know something, it becomes more and more uncomfortable because you see the hooks and the corners and the imperfections in the thing, and it's hard to talk about the area of your own skill and your own discipline. If it were not for Bowman's presence, I might say that at this point you simply tend to get dogmatic, say, and start making assertions without the evidence or the reason to back them up. Yet, you have a continuum here, because the self-determination and the conditioning that occurs are not really that unrelated to each other. They are part and parcel of the same package, at least to a very large degree. We must try and develop a system that accommodates both of them. One could very easily argue that in order to develop at all, to move forward at all, that you have to interfere with systems that are operating already. Somebody has to make judgments, come in, change things. You have to help people help themselves. And this is true, I think, despite Paul's observation, perhaps to the contrary, on the international level as well as it is on the national level. I do not see how one can really draw lines between my relation to you as an individual and my family's relation to you as a family, and my county's relation to your county, and my state to your state, and my nation to your nation. Where do you get off? If you're talking about a legal system, isn't it always my interest versus your interests? In whatever groupings, whatever subsystems, we may happen to find ourselves operating. But the difficulty with interfering in the system that exists and doing something about it, in addition to the fact that it requires coercion, is also that there is this very large area for making mistakes, doing it wrong. And the reason that we are prone to error in these things, I think, is because we don't have the validation of our self-interest constantly checking us. This is the nice thing about a system which is competitive, because about the time that you want to do something that I see as being against my interest, I say, wait, maybe we haven't thought this through as carefully as we should. There are some other things that we can think about yet to test out the validity. Now, with this much by way of background, to try and set up the nature of the problem, let's take a look at what we call poverty. Just plain poverty in the United States. What do you do about it? How do you try to do what we sometimes call interrupt the culture or the cycle of poverty, the nature of poverty? If we can do anything systematic with that, maybe we can make applications later to other contexts too. Back in the 1930s, when we got our first critical legislation in this area, we adopted, at least theoretically, at least on the books, the concept that we were giving people things, we were supplying people with needs, that is food and shelter and clothing and so forth, not as gifts, but as a matter of legal entitlement. They were entitled to it. We, by legislation, Congress and by the states, said that these people have a legally enforceable right to have the minimums necessary. And this has been our theory, our legislated theory, ever since the 30s. I didn't work that way. We rather decided that what we had to do was to help people. Help people by moving in on them and saying, since you people are disabled, since you are not competent people, or since you are people who haven't behaved correctly, since you've been unable to take care of yourselves, or since you are lazy and shiftless, or whatever it may be, whatever caused this condition of poverty on your part, you obviously are incompetent to take care of your own problems, and therefore we're going to have to help you. One might use the idea of paternalism here to express this sort of feeling. And you will notice that paternalism is, in one way, the direct opposite of the concept of self-determination. The kind of law that I was talking about last evening works in the context of adversaries. It's very necessary. It's my interests against your interests, we slug it out, that is, we argue it out, we contest it out, before a judge who, having heard all the facts, being aware of what the rules are, makes a determination. Now, this kind of adversarial approach, the debate, the interchange, the public articulated evaluation of the utilities that are involved will work only when you have people who can express their positions, the comparative strength of the two sides. This is, incidentally, why it is so important in our legal system, which is not obvious. I mean, there is a skill in law. It's why it's so necessary that persons be represented by a counsel, by a skilled spokesman, by somebody who knows the system and can make it work, in order to get a full explication of what's going on so the judge can make a reasonable judgment. Now, this adversarial approach will not work where you have one party who is incapable of speaking for himself and who is not represented. So when we get to somebody like infants, or like mentally incompetent persons, or idiots, or other helpless souls like married women, or anybody else that we decide to classify as being less than a person's soul, that is, a whole person, a person of limited capacity, then we must shift over to something other than this person against that person, because competitive pressure between two greatly divergent forces will not produce the kind of innovation and ingenious activity that we would like to see. You can say to a six-month-old baby, get up off of that bed, you shiftless individual, and get out and be ingenious and develop a better mousetrap, and the world will be the path to your doorway, but the kid won't do it. And if you decide to use operant conditioning and say, well, I'll starve you into it, you don't get your next bottle until you're up out of there working. He still doesn't do it simply because he doesn't have the capacity. And when we find a person who is incompetent of participating in life's games, these are very serious games to be sure, but when you find a person who is incompetent of participating in this give and take in the adversarial, the competitive, the adjudicated, the law kind of process, then we go paternalistic. That is, we say, this is my child, it's my responsibility to look after him, I'm going to father him, to be paternalistic, I'm going to see to it that he's helped, I'll help him make decisions. I own one infant myself, 18-year-old, 6'4", recently had his picture taken at graduation, holding me instead of me holding him. It's very difficult for a father who has become paternalistic at some point in the development to stop being paternalistic and let the ward become a person who develops his own strength and his own capacities. To let go is a very difficult thing. Now, how does that apply in what we're talking about in poverty? Well, when we moved in with poverty, we started with the conception, as I've already said, in our legislation that this was a matter of legal right. These people were entitled to have money. They were entitled to have shelter. They were entitled to have whatever they needed in order to live a reasonable, decent life. But, we said, because these people are obviously incompetents, or else they wouldn't be in that situation in the first place, therefore we can't just give them something and expect them to use it to their own best interests. We've got to see to it that they use it wisely. Now, before you deny that, think of how frequently we say to each other, there's no use giving those people down there in Skid Row all that money and cash, they'll just go out and buy beer. See, they're quite unwilling to say, give this person what he needs to buy food and depend upon him to make his decisions. Because you are convinced that this man is incompetent and that he can't make his decisions. He can't be trusted with these kind of assets, and therefore you have to help him. And we have developed a beautiful system of helps in the United States. Now, at this point, before I alienate everybody who has any kind thoughts about anybody else, I will do that shortly, but before I do that, I want to tell you that my heart is true, my interests are well meant, among other things that I've had the privilege of doing and do now, as a matter of fact. I chair a committee in the state of Washington which advises the State Department of Public Assistance. We are appointed by the governor, and it is my job, among other things, to see to it that our public assistance program works well. We dish out $310 million a biennium trying to alleviate poverty. And although I am not a social work trained person, that's why I'm comfortable talking about it. Nonetheless, I am not totally a stranger to this picture either. Now, having said that, observe what happens. From a period of real crisis in the 30s, where suddenly a very dramatic event threw out of employment and out of normal work patterns a great number of people who were wholly capable of working for themselves. And there were people who were skilled, who were educated, who were trained, who could do a job. But a certain and violent shift in our economy, quote, temporarily displaced these people and put them out of a job. From that situation, we have deteriorated to the place where we have carefully perpetuated and developed and have hand-grown a group of people who are not able to take care of themselves, who really are not educated, who really have no skills, who aren't trained. And that's because we have, here I think maybe Paul and I would tread the same path, because we have carefully been paternalistic over them, and we have sheltered them, and we've not let them experience enough of the knocks and roughness, the rough and tumble, to give them the purpose to develop their own strengths and their own capacities. We haven't trusted them with money to go out and buy beer if they want to. We rather have said to them, well, obviously you can't handle money, therefore come with us down to the warehouse and we will give you the right number of calories of food that you can't do anything else with, to be sure that you won't have to make decisions and therefore possibly make errors. Because you're a little child, you don't make decisions for yourself, we make them for you. Perhaps you can see that best in the context of a rather recent, widely publicized judicial struggle in connection with the juvenile courts in the United States. I would use this as an illustration of what I'm talking about. Prior to 1890 in the United States, we let the full rigor of the adversarial criminal law process work with children as well as with adults. We were still executing capital punishment, children who were 12 and 13 years of age in the United States. Some people thought that was a little rough on the kids. They didn't have the capacity, perhaps, to understand the nature of their own conduct, and we ought to ameliorate that situation somewhat by having a special kind of program for children. It ultimately became known as the juvenile courts. The juvenile court program in the beginning was a court which promised children who were found to be delinquent and who needed attention of some sort. It promised these children special facilities, special care, special people to work with them. But it must be most emphatically stated that these were children who were to be thus cared for or thus rehabilitated only after they had been found to be delinquents by the process that the law normally used to mark a person a delinquent. That is, only after they had had a full trial, an adversarial setting. Now, what happened was, as so frequently happens, that we got quite carried away with our own capacity here. And having decided that we like to rehabilitate children and give them special advantages, we soon developed the notion that any child who didn't have the benefit of such treatment was a child who was missing out on something. The literature in the 1920s and 1930s dealing with juvenile courts, full of statements saying that a child who is not given the advantage of the special treatments under the juvenile court is a child who is deprived. You notice how far we have come then in this swing away from the concept that one is best left to develop his own capacities and strength in his own way, and that society will encroach upon him only in the event that there has been a clear demonstration of the inability of that person to take care of himself. Well, once we sprung the gates open and let that one go, the juvenile courts became avowedly a paternalistic court where we were acting in the welfare of the child. It's the state of Washington, not against Johnny Jones, a minor, but the state of Washington on behalf of, in the interests of Johnny Jones, a miner. Johnny couldn't take care of himself, and so we were going to take care of him by the state's activities, by the state's programs. What happened in reality, of course, is that we simply used this as a way of anchoring in on the boy, taking him away from his home and giving him nothing on the other end. The destruction of the juvenile court system in the United States is largely a product that we didn't put our money where our mouth was. We said that we would give them special treatment, special facilities, special care, but we didn't. All that we did was take away the protections that the child was entitled to if he were going to be treated under the criminal law. I think that must be illustrated by a couple recent cases so that you'll understand what it means. The first of these two cases is one decided in 1965. It's rather remarkable that from 1890 to 1965, the United States Supreme Court had never looked at a juvenile court problem. It's the reason for this, of course, is that the Supreme Court, as I was trying to persuade you last night, is basically a very conservative body. They don't like to fiddle with local problems unless they have to. But in 1965 came the case of the United States against Kent. Morris Kent was a boy in Washington, D.C., 15 years of age, already known to the court. He was a ward of the court because of prior misconduct. Back home with his family, if one can call his living arrangement a family. And Morris got into serious trouble. He broke into an apartment. He robbed the person there, a woman, an elderly woman. He raped her. It's a serious kind of misconduct indeed. And he was a child who was acting out pretty positively. Under the juvenile court law of Washington, D.C., that's where this happened, Morris, if found to be a delinquent boy, could be held in a rehabilitation setting until he was the age of 21. He was then 15, so the maximum thing that could have happened to him would have been 6 years in detention or in rehabilitation care, or whatever you want to call it. When his problem came to the court in Washington, D.C., the judge, without holding a hearing, and without considering any evidence, without really talking to Morris, without doing any sort of a psychological investigation, in short, without really informing himself, just looked at the record and then looked at the act and said, this is not a kid that we want cluttering up our juvenile courts, bounce him over to the criminal court and let him be tried as an adult, as a criminal. Now, there are some difficulties in that process because when one is being tried as a criminal, there are a great many safeguards that are given to protect the criminal from having information obtained without being subjected to cross-examination. He has a right not to incriminate himself by a confession without being first alerted to the fact that he has a right not to incriminate himself. None of these things were accorded Morris Kent. Rather, he was simply bounced over without much ceremony to the adult court to be tried as a criminal. In Washington, D.C., they execute people for this kind of conduct. And so his exposure goes from 6 years to the possibility of capital punishment. And all of a sudden, he decides he wants to be a juvenile. He says, I like this paternalism stuff. Keep me here in the juvenile court. You cannot deprive me of the protections which society has given me in the Juvenile Court Act without the process which is due to me. That's what's known as a violation of due process. There is a process which has to be followed in order to deprive me of the rights which the statute says that I have. And these processes were not followed, and therefore I have been deprived of protection and and in violation of the statute in Washington, D.C. And the court found that. Now, this was the opening wedge in the juvenile court system. The next case, the one that was decided just this spring, is by all odds the more significant case. It's almost exactly the opposite of the Kent case. It involved a boy by the name of Ronald Gault, G-A-U-L-T, in Nevada. Ronald, living there with his mother and father. His father was out of town working on a construction project. His mother was employed and working in the town itself. Ronald and his playmate next door, another 15-year-old boy, were in the house alone. Time got a little heavy. They decided to have a little fun, so they dialed the neighbor lady, Mrs. Cook, on the telephone. Somebody dialed her telephone, at least, and then somebody said over the phone, some things which could be regarded as being indecent or obscene comments about Mrs. Cook. She hit the ceiling and called the fuzz, as the kids would say, and the police found Ronald and his playmates still in the house and took them down to the juvenile center where they were interrogated. Now, making indecent and obscene remarks over a telephone to a woman or a child in Nevada is a violation of an ordinance, and one can be punished for a violation of this ordinance by being fined $50 or being put into the local jail for 2 months. That's if you're an adult and you're going to feel the full rigor of the criminal law. But Morris was a 15-year-old, and if he could be found to be a delinquent child, as he shortly was found to be a delinquent child, he could be put into a rehabilitation facility until he was the age of 21. In other words, he could get 6 years. Now, this is just the opposite of what happened in Kent, you see, and all of a sudden, Galt says, I don't want to be a juvenile. Treat me like an adult criminal, will you? And fine me $50 and let me go home instead of incarcerating me for 6 years. So you've got the opposite side of the coin going for you. Now, Galt was interesting because nobody bothered to tell Mr. and Mrs. Galt what they had their boy down at the station for. And they finally got around to filing a petition, but they never gave the parents a copy. They didn't give Ronald a copy either. In fact, it seems that the petition really wasn't filed until about 3 or 4 months after the action was heard. When Mrs. Galt went down to see Ronald, the judge said, well, we're going to have a hearing about the boy. In the meantime, we'll just keep him here, not telling her what it was all about. A couple days later, she came back, and there was a hearing. The probation officer from the court had talked to Mrs. Cook, and Mrs. Cook said that the boy had called her and made these remarks over the telephone. So the judge said to Ronald, now, Ronald, son, isn't that so? And Ronald said, no, he didn't do any such thing. Well, now, you're not supposed to do that in the juvenile court. It muddies up the whole process. You're just supposed to say yes, like a good obedient child, and take your whipping and go to bed. But he said, no, I didn't. And the judge then turned to the probation officer and said, did he make these comments over the phone? And the probation officer said, well, I understood Mrs. Cook to say that. Whereupon Mrs. Galt, Ronald's mother, said, wouldn't it be nice if we could get Mrs. Cook down here and see if she recognizes Ronald's voice or see what was really said? Why don't we ask her to come in and tell us what it was all about, since my boy seems to feel that he wasn't implicated in this? And the judge said, we know your son. We've watched him around the community. He's a child that's been in trouble from time to time, and he needs some help. And as far as we're concerned, he made the comments over the telephone, and there's no use pushing the thing any further. My probation officer has talked to Mrs. Cook, and that's the end of it. Now, this is kind of like bringing a man before a judge and saying, do you plead guilty or innocence? And you say, of what, Your Honor? And he says, I'm not going to tell you. Just say yes or no. And you say, well, how am I supposed to make a defense if I don't know what the charges are? And the answer to that is, don't worry about that. We're here for your good, acting in your welfare. Just trust us to run your life. This is really what is happening. And predictably enough, when it got to the U.S. Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court said, this simply will not do. This kind of a juvenile court structure is not tolerable to us. There must be a certain amount of ceremony if you're going to take a person against his will, involuntarily, out of society, and do something else with him. You must have a defensible reason, and you must be able to demonstrate that reason and prove it by cogent evidence. Now back off from that, will you? Back to our poverty program again. If there is such a thing as legal entitlement, if a person is entitled to an adequate amount of food, or if a person is entitled to an adequate grant in money, then he is entitled to it. And he's entitled to it without strings attached to it. It isn't fair to say to the person, you're hungry, aren't you? How would you like some money? And he says, well, is that the money that the statute says that I'm entitled to get? And you say, yes, it is. But before you get it, we want to make a few adjustments in your life. We want to help you shape up and fly right. We would like to affirmatively do some social work with you. We'd like to help you reestablish new patterns which are conforming to what we as society think is best for your interest. This is a kind of rank paternalism. When we condition aid or assistance on a willingness of the person to accept our notions of how they ought to get along, we are now seeing a swing away from this thinking in the United States, in the juvenile court, most assuredly and dramatically, and also in the concept of a poverty program or of a welfare program. Because these programs are now trying to say that a person is entitled to demand legally his share, his portion. Here one can get into real difficulty without trying very hard by saying, for example, that civil disobedience is a part of such a process. A government, perhaps, is as strong as its capacity to subsidize revolt against itself. A revolt now in the sense of saying to a person, we think you ought to do this, but here is a chunk of dough. Go out and hire yourself a lawyer and see whether or not you can prove that we're wrong. Or if a government can help people to learn enough about what their rights are so that those people can stand up and say, take your hands off of me, I'm entitled to more, or I'm entitled to something different. Or if government can actually move it out into a society and say, the trouble with you people out here is if you aren't organized, why don't you form a union of ADC mothers? This is precisely what we're doing in Seattle currently. We're asking our ADC mothers to form groups in which they will carefully listen to what people are able to tell them about what their rights are under the statute, and then come in and demand their rights. Or we are saying to them, we think it is unconstitutional for you to receive less than what the statute says that you are entitled to receive. And we currently, in the state of Washington, are paying you less than you are entitled to receive. Now, we're the guys who are doing it, and we wish that you would sue us. We know that you don't have enough capacity to sue us because you are not yet geared into what your legal rights are. So we will give you some money, and we will ask you to go out and employ counsel to sue us to make us do what we think ought to be done. Now, what we think the law says we ought to be doing, because we are incapable of doing this ourselves. You want a good illustration of that sort of thing? Let me give it to you. We have in the state of Washington something which I think is unconstitutional. We share this with about 16 other states, so I don't have any pride of exclusive possession. In our ADC program, we regulate the amount of money which a person is to receive by the father, the mother, the ages of the children, except that after we get to a certain dollar value, we say that's the maximum that you can get in one family. Now, no matter how many other children you've got, when you get to this number of dollars, that's all you get. And then you just got to put more water in the soup. This is a maximum grant. Now, why a maximum grant? A maximum grant simply because we say that no family on public assistance ought to get more than the family that's working for itself, no matter if there's a different number of children involved in there. It's simply an arbitrary ceiling, and one politically fixed. Now, in order to overcome that kind of a maximum or that kind of an arbitrary limitation, we say, why don't you choose us up on this point? Why don't you sue us? Why don't you see if you can get the court to say that it's unconstitutional? And that's kind of a nutty thing to say, except that I know, as a member of our advisory committee, that I haven't got a ghost of a chance of getting that problem rectified through our legislature. It would cost $2.5 million in my state. At least that's what my friendly data processing machine tells me. And we just aren't going to get that kind of extra money unless there is some coercion applied by having a court say that you may not constitutionally do what you've been doing before. Now, take that principle, if you will, and apply it to another group. One might think of a group that happens to be differentiated from this group, let's say, in pigmentation. Now, if this group happened to be living under less than adequate conditions, if there were any validity to the idea that they had been improperly treated, unfairly treated, if they had not been given that to which they were entitled, would this group have the right to call attention to that disparity in treatment by making it manifest, by making it observable, by doing it in a way that it could be seen by people. You know the story about the man that sold a mule? And the buyer said, I want a mule that's tractable, that behaves, it does what I tell him to. And will this mule stop and go when you say, whoa, and giddy up? Oh, sure, says the seller, certainly will. So he took the mule. The next day he came back and he said, the mule won't go when I say giddy up, and if he does go, he won't stop when I say stop. So the man who had sold it took the mule's reins and shook them once and said, giddy up, and didn't go anywhere. So he picked up a single tree. For those of you who don't happen to be from the right kind of area, that's like a great big baseball bat. He went around front and slugged the mule between the ears and said, get up! And the mule went. And the buyer said, well, I thought you said he obeyed commands. The man says, he does, but first you've got to get his attention. That's what you see going on. There are injustices which have existed so long. There are inequalities which have existed so long in our pattern that we don't even see them anymore. Either that or else we like it that way. And I almost prefer the first thought, that it's blind stupidity, than the second, which makes us out to be a pretty bad bunch of people, really. And somehow or other, our attention must be arrested. We must be brought short to the fact that there are these problems in society. Seattle is a clean, modern city. Just before I left in the legal aid office, we filed 3 rat bite cases with children. Seattle is a rather open city with a lot of housing. We're not crowded. A week before I came down here, I visited a home in which they lift the furniture off of the floor by ropes at night and tie it to the ceiling, so they've got enough room to lie down in the one room. Seattle is a modern city where we don't have problems of real severity like we so frequently do in the rest of the city. The day before I left, I got a phone call from a woman who called my attention to some children who were actually roped to the posts of the bed, almost starving to death. These problems exist, you see, in your town as well as mine, and we're able to look right over the top of them. And somehow or other, one's consciousness must be arrested, and you've got to be brought up sharp to these things, because they are a very, very real problem. Now, how do you arrest attention? Well, one sees a certain amount of striking out. Civil disobedience is not one undifferentiated blob. It comes in different sizes. There are, of course, always ways of testing the validity of our laws and of our regulation. I like this method myself. As a lawyer, I would be very much in favor of educational programs which say to people, look, Congress has said, and the state of Washington has said, and the city of Seattle has said in its enactments that you are entitled to these things. And now I would like to give you what it takes to inform you of those rights and to provide you with the counsel and the courts in order to test them out and get what we have agreed socially is lawfully yours. But every time I wind up and go down to the legislating bodies and say I want $25 or $30 million, in order to set up legal aid offices so that we can sue the state so people can get more money, they regard me as being some kind of a leper. So we have the ability to resist this kind of thing, and we don't really help people to become independent and assert their own position in society. And finally, enough steam breaks up so that they start doing things like carrying pickets around, or maybe growing beards. Or something of that sort. Delighted to find that not only Hain, but also Bowman has a beard. That's a beating around the brush. You get this kind of thing. Here I must be very careful. You know, I suppose some of you people know George Farrell back in Iowa. He's a very fine Lutheran theologian. I was debating him once in the wilds of South Dakota on a subject that I think it was more in his field than mine, because he was getting the better of the argument, and I decided the only thing left to do was to insult him. He has a fine beard. He's got a bald head. So first I started out by suggesting he'd made a mistake that morning and got his head on upside down. That didn't seem to faze him, so pretty soon I started getting a little bit nastier and said, Father Abraham, and Brother Jacob, and all of that sort of stuff, you know. And finally, he did get a little irritated, and I found out it's dangerous to fool with these animated brush people. Farrell says, Ricky, I've had enough. I'm not Abraham and I'm not Jacob. I'm Kish, the son of Saul, out in search of my father's ass, and lo, I've found him. But that this is the second level that a person can do. If we will not provide him with counsel and with the platform from which he can contest and demand his own rights, then he must do something else to call attention to his own plight. This may be sit-downs. It may be carrying pickets. Now, one here can ask, and I won't ask now, maybe we can ask some other time, whether or not this is a proper kind of corporate activity for the church as a corporate body. Maybe we ought to be carrying a few more pickets, a few more signs around than we do. If that doesn't work, you've got one thing left, and that is violence. Civil disobedience that comes over to the point of not only disobeying peacefully, you know, I broke the law, okay, take me in, put me in prison, but even to the place where violence is involved. And we are, of course, seeing in the United States today, we are reaping this kind of a whirlwind. Watts, the other instances that have occurred since then, are manifestations of this sort of thing. Once more, dramatically calling attention to injustices. Now, I know, at least I think I know, that one wrong does not justify another wrong. One injustice does not justify another injustice. But notice how judgmental I become at this point. Must one not rather look first to oneself and say, we haven't kept our own promises? Not even on a basis of law have we done what we promised legally to do. We have not kept our own word with respect to these people. And then what do you do? Two levels. One of which I wish to mention here in a sentence or two, and the other of which I'd like to talk about a little bit Thursday. The first of these levels is just plain setting up your machinery so it has utility. I mean your law machinery, your rules, so it has utility. The sort of thing that Paul talks about when he says behaving rationally. It's cheaper to be rational and to provide people with what they need than it is to go on perpetuating this thing that we call the cycle of poverty forever. That must be interfered with somewhere. But how? I don't think by paternalism. I think that the interruption must come by finally steeling ourselves to the point where we give these people what they need and permit them to run their own lives. And if that means that we've got a lot of people out with public assistance money, drinking beer, and living in adultery, that's what it's got to mean. Even a legislator can understand dollars and cents. And when you can say to a legislator, look, you've got a guy out here, I can give you this man in the state of Washington, of course, I may not under the rules of confidentiality, but he exists, believe me. He's a competent bookkeeper. He earned a good living. It happened that he became ill. He went to a hospital. He lost everything he had in the process. Came out the other end, he could be a bookkeeper again, but he has no glasses. And you give him public assistance month after month, but you won't buy him a pair of glasses. Why in the name of thunder don't you buy him a pair of glasses? It would be cheaper in the long run, and a legislator can understand that. Or I can say to a legislator, I have a lady out here who used to be a secretary. She's a pretty good one, too. She had all her teeth extracted. The state will do that for people, pull their teeth. But we don't have enough money to give them dentures. She's having a certain amount of difficulty getting a job as a secretary. Most employers like their secretary to have their teeth. Wouldn't it be cheaper, really, to buy a set of dentures and let the woman become self-sustaining? A legislator can see that argument. And when they're thinking hard, they can even see an argument which says, look, it's going to take 10 years or 15 years, but you must give these children the attention that they need now so that they won't be subjected to the childhood diseases, so that they don't grow up suffering all of the mental and the physical disablements which produce poverty in the first place. You must give them enough education, enough training, so that they will be self-enabling, self-motivating persons in our society. A legislator can see that too. So far, I've not had much luck. by saying, look, people in our society relate to each other by a system that we call law. They must know what an installment contract is or where to go to get some advice about it. Otherwise, they're going to be bled penniless by installment contracts which are outrageously unfair to the person who is in poverty. Look, people relate to each other in housing by what we call landlord and tenant law. They must know about the landlord and tenant law, or they must have available to them the services of a person who does. Otherwise, they are outrageously treated by slumlords in intolerable housing conditions and thrown out in the street at the least pretense. Therefore, we must give these people access to our dispute-settling machinery in the courts. This argument is not a very acceptable one yet. I would suggest to you that this, although difficult for a legislator to see, ought not be so difficult for you to see if you really are interested in a person as a whole person, as a person who, as a child of God, is a self-determining unit and entitled to make these sorts of determinations to the greatest of his own capacity. That's all that I want to say today, but by way of forecast. Next hour, when we get together, when I get to talk to you, I'd like to suggest to you that your opportunity is an even broader one than that. I think that the unique quality of the gospel is that it enables you to be foolish, to do things which don't add up logically or rationally on the level of legal behavior, but rather to go quite beyond this and to express a kind of foolish, self-effacing selflessness which is realistic in the world to people who have the capacity to do it. Think of this in terms of the gospel. But we'll argue about that next hour.